And it is a great pleasure to welcome back to the program one of my truly favorite guests, John Drummond. As I said a moment ago, he's generally considered the leading street reporter in the history, at least the modern history, of Chicago. He's been everywhere. His beat has basically been crime, but a great deal else as well. And you know them all. You know, I was thinking of you just the other day when I was driving downtown and I passed that brooding, strange, modern building in the South Loop, namely the Metropolitan Correction Center. And I thought to myself, Tony Resco's in there, of course. But then you reminded me in a chat we had just before the program began, you reminded me that so are the five convicted defendants in the Family Secrets trial, five of the leading members of the mob, or as we call it in Chicago, the outfit. Do you think they've struck up a friendship with Resco?
That's a good point. Resco supposedly is secluded. Whether he, I have a feeling they probably met the man, despite the fact there's supposed to be denials. Those men have been there, with the exception of Joe Lombardo. We're talking all the Family Secrets defendants since April of 2005. In fact, one of
even
them,
though they were committed, they were convicted
a year ago. They're convicted
and
in September.
After convicted, they should be taken out of jail and put into prison.
You thought that this would have been adjudicated earlier, but what happened, of course, is that some of the attorneys for the defendants appealed, as you'd expect. That took a time. I think the Justice Department was waiting until that was finalized, and the appeals were denied, to my knowledge. And then you had, of course, a shortage with the strike force people that did the prosecution. Mitch Mars, who, of course, was the lead prosecutor, passed away because of cancer at a relatively young age, very capable individual. John Scully, retired. He was the second prosecutor on it, and the third man is leaves one man, Mr. Funk. So those are there's three people, and they are shorthanded there too. So supposedly these individuals are going to be indicted sometime, will be sentenced sometime in January, and also, by the way, scheduled to be sentenced in January is a man by the name of Nicholas Calabrese, who was the government's key witness in the Family Secrets case. He's the one who spilled the beans.
And so he'll get a shorter sentence, of course.
Yeah, I'm sure he will. That's a good question, because he cooperated, even though he himself was involved in murders.
Have these guys been replaced? Have there been others standing in the wings who've now come to center stage and taken over so that the outfit still flourishes as well as it ever did?
I don't think it flourishes. You're probably never going to eliminate organized crime completely, but I know, according to federal authorities, as of last fall, they were contending at that time a man by the name of James Marcello, who was one of the Family Secret defendants, was still the head of the mob, even though he had been incarcerated at the MCC said
away. Wasn't there a Marcello years ago who ran the mafia down in New Orleans?
That's correct. Carlos Marcello. That's right. A very powerful mob figure in the Crescent City.
Are these guys related?
Not to my knowledge. He, of course, is deceased. He was considered one of the most powerful mob figures in the country at one time.
He was
allegedly, supposedly wanted to get rid of Bobby Kennedy. That is,
he was picked up by Bobby Kennedy and dropped into a jungle someplace in Central America because he wasn't a citizen, apparently. And they could get rid of him that way. But he came back, and supposedly, according to some of the conspiracy theorists, he helped to organize the plot to kill JFK.
If you're a grassy knoll person, supposedly Marcello, that is not James Marcello, referring to Carlos, the New Orleans man, supposedly said that Kennedy, Bob Kennedy, was the pebble in his shoe, and he also had vented rage against JFK as well.
By the way, I'm just going to wander around as if you and I were sitting there having two beers. Maybe four beers before we're done.
I need four.
All right? If I wander a little bit loosely, you'll forgive me on that. But I'm just gossiping and just poking around in the rich file stored in your very, very capacious mind. Speaking of the mafia and speaking of the assassination of JFK, it was before your time, but what did you ever pick up from others who knew him and knew about him, about Jack Ruby?
Well, I'm glad you bring that up, the Ruby thing, because I was thinking of that the other day. I recall the allegations that he was an outfit guy here in Chicago before he moved to Dallas.
Yeah.
I recall that when his name surfaced, the authorities in Dallas, I believe the police chief, sent a letter to Virgil Peterson, who at that time was head of the Chicago Crime Commission and was a very respected crime fighter. And I have a copy, or did have a copy, of that letter that Peterson wrote back to the Dallas police chief, saying that Ruby, in effect, was not an outfit, not a member of the syndicate by any means. He was a hanger-on, or maybe, and the things like that.
Of course, he was a Jewish guy. So
yes, he was.
He could
have been.
He could not be a made man.
I always heard allegations that he was friendly with Lenny Patrick and other people that were part of the Jewish mob, so to speak. But there's been, according to Peterson, there was no evidence to support the fact that he was an actual organized crime figure here in Chicago.
Did you ever take a position on, it wasn't on your beat, the assassination of JFK, happened far away, happened in Dallas. Did you ever take a position on it?
Yes, my position, obviously I wouldn't be able to debate people, have done a lot of work on it. I don't believe there was any conspiracy. In this case, I believe that Oswald shot him. I do believe, by the way, in the case of James Earl Ray, and when he shot Dr. King in April 1968, I believe that he might have been financed. I believe there was a conspiracy in that case. I believe that somebody had to finance the man because he was basically a petty criminal.
And he made a very slick getaway.
That's right. Ended up in, you're exactly correct. I felt, I remember there was allegations at the time or afterwards that he had been financed by a group of white supremacists in St. Louis, Missouri. But nothing ever came of that. But I've always felt that in that case, you could have there grounds for a conspiracy.
So we're talking about murders. You see, as I say, I'm going to pre-associate, go from one thing to another. Murders brings me back to Chicago and to mob murders. Are there any great unsolved mob murders still?
You know, since you brought it up, I'll tell you one I was thinking of the other day. 1981, as you were, it was 1977, I believe, that four men were found murdered, shot to death, in an elevator in an office building in suburban Park Ridge. That has never been clear, never got much ink. There was four men that belonged, they worked at a security firm. They may have been involved in some kind of scam, I don't know. But when the secretary opened the door to the elevator to go to work that day, she found four bodies stacked like cordwood in there. That case has never been cleared, never been cleared at all. And that was going back some 30 years now.
You have an hypothesis on that one?
I think that, yes, it was not, my hypothesis would have been that it dealt with the business, that apparently that there was no evidence that this was any kind of robbery or anything like that. It was definitely, quote, a hit. And apparently they had done somebody in, owed somebody money, and it all went down the drain.
A great mob murder, the mob murdering one of its own, was the killing of Spilotro, which may have involved actually burying him alive. Is that right?
At the time, and we're going back now to 1986 when the Spilotro brothers were killed. There was a book that came out and called Casino, later made into a popular movie with Robert De Niro taking the role of Lefty Rosenthal type guy, and Joe Pesci as Tony Spilotro. In the movie, if you recall, at the end, the men were taken to this cornfield, and supposedly in Indiana, and they were beaten to death while they were alive, buried alive probably at that time. Now, what happened in the trial of the Family Secrets case, when this thing indictment came down in 2005, the government contended then that the men, that is the Spilotros, were murdered in suburban Bensonville in the basement of a home there, and they were transported then to this farm in Morocco, Indiana, where they were buried, and ergo they wouldn't have been buried alive if that's true. Now, the reason the government contends that is that's based basically on the testimony and the information of a man by the name of Nicholas Calabrese, who said he was not, not only he was involved in the actual murder, and that version that would, of course, dispute the version that was given by Hollywood that they were buried alive. So the Calabrese theory is the theory that's been obviously been supported by the authorities, and the official one is that they were killed in Bensonville.
When does the mob decide to kill one of its own? Why did they kill him? Why, for that matter, did they kill Sam Giancana?
Well, let's take, boy, we're going back a ways now. Okay, let's start with Sam Giancana. He was murdered, through some of their listeners may recall, way back, it was June of 1975. He had just come back a year later, a year earlier, from a self-imposed exile in Mexico. He lived pretty well down there in a suburb of Cuernavaca, in a suburb of Mexico City. He went there because he was being, frankly, he was given, he had been held in contempt of court, spent a year at the county jail, and he left on his own. He came back in 1974, he got kicked out of the country, came back to Chicago, lived in Oak Park. Now, there's several theories. Why did he get killed? Number one, and the theory I think is most likely, is that he, Giancana, came back. He wanted the same status that he had before. He wanted his piece of the pie. And I think he was told by the elders, like Mr. Accardo and Mr. Ayupa, that that wasn't true anymore. That was then. This is now. And I think they decided to hit him, and they did. Now, there was another theory that was advanced, and I don't take, again, the conspiracy theorists. Here we go again. That he did go before a grand jury in Chicago. That's correct. But I know that a person told me that was very familiar with that grand jury, he didn't tell them anything. They were concerned by this theory that he was going to spill the beans about the Castro thing and things of that nature, and that's why he was killed for that, by the CIA, and I don't buy that whatsoever.
When you speak of the Castro thing, that's the job that he, Giancana, and one other guy took on.
John Roselli was the other
John Roselli, for the CIA.
Yes.
To go after Castro.
exploding cigars, poison, all that stuff, which I don't think they made much of an effort on it. And by the way,
it had a comic side.
Oh, sure it was. I don't think they didn't take anything. They went in, the mob, a little time, can be a paper tiger too. I think they conned these guys with the CIA. I believe that. And by the way, to kill
Fidel with a poison cigar.
Whatever it was.
That was a con, wasn't it?
That's right. But I think the biggest theory to rebut the idea that the CIA was involved in the murder of Sam Giancana was at the funeral of Giancana.
Yeah.
Nobody showed up at that funeral, with the exception of Butch Blasi, who, of course, was his chauffeur, and who may have been the one who was killed, by the way. In other words, the story was, but Ricardo Ayup and these people told him to stay away. In other words, he didn't get any respect. Now, if he'd have been killed by a government agency and was still in good accord, they'd have been out there paying their respects, and they didn't show up.
Now, in that same recent Family Secrets case, wasn't there a disclosure? Was it a direct disclosure, or at least an intimation as to who the actual hitman was on Giancana?
That didn't come out at that time, but I'll tell you right now, everybody, of course, involved in that case is deceased. If we go back, and I know we've discussed this on the show before, and I hope it doesn't bore some of your listeners who've heard this before, but what happened was that Mr. Giancana had come back in 1975 he had gallbladder surgery down in Houston, Texas, by the renowned Dr. Donald DeBakey, by the way, was the surgeon. He had come back, and his relatives came over and had, not to call it a hail, party of some kind, but they just wanted to pay their respects. That included two of his daughters with their husbands, and Charles English, and one of his other Confederates and friends, Butch Blasi. We know this because the police, Chicago Police Department intelligence unit, was parked out in front of Giancana's home that night on Winona Avenue in Oak Park. They saw these people come in. They saw them leave. And then just before they pulled out, Butch Blasi returned alone. They were then called off on some other assignment.
Uh-huh.
About an hour later, or less than an hour later, Mr. Giancana's houseman called the police in Oak Park that the body of Sam Giancana was found in the basement. Now, they went down there. There was no evidence of any break-in, no evidence of anybody forcibly getting into the house. Whoever killed Giancana was let in by Sam himself, someone obviously he knew and trusted.
And he was cooking sausage. Peppers and sausage.
That's exactly his food that he could not have had with that, would not have tried to eat after that recent gallbladder surgery. So he was cooking it for his friend, whoever that was, and somebody put 7 bullets into him with a .22 into his forehead.
The conventional outfit, that is the Italian outfit, supposedly is somewhat diminished in its function in supplying all the illegal niceties that people want to get, whether drugs, prostitution, or juice loans, or what have you. But apparently other outfits have been taking over. We need to talk about sort of the structure of street crime and related kinds of operations in Chicago these days. Let's talk about that right after we take care of these messages. And we return directly to John Drummond, ace street reporter, crime reporter, wonderful career at WBBM Television. Of course, that wasn't your first job, but you went there quite early in the 1960s.
I started work at WBBM, that is TV Channel 2, in 1969. I was at WIND, a rival at that time of GN in the mid-60s. I was there for...
But from 69 down to the present, because now you're...
Well, pretty much retired now.
But you're still called in to do things, and you're doing other freelance operations.
Yes, that's correct.
Some of it in television and so on. And you're writing just absolutely riveting books. A few years ago, there was 30 Years in the Trenches, and now another book, which appeared only last year, It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real. What ain't pretty?
Well, I have to admit, that was actually a slogan that they used at Channel 2 at one time, because that's when we did our newscasts from the newsroom. In other words, we weren't like the pretty boys that they had with the studio and that type of thing. They had the teletypers or clicking away and that type of stuff. Of course, they've gone back to the studios now, but that was the slogan that we used at that time.
Now, something else that ain't pretty but is certainly real is organized crime activity in the major American cities, including, surely, Chicago, which was in many ways the capital of organized crime, at least during the days of Al Capone and so on. Who has been taking over from the Italian-based outfit?
Well, I think first of all, that in recent years, the Italian-based outfit, which the Cosa Nostra, the outfit as we call them, was not involved primarily.
They never called it the mafia.
No, never. That's an Eastern thing. Yeah. There's always been a traditional no-no as far as dealing with narcotics, but I think that there's been cases of individuals here that have been involved in drugs. But the biggest crime factors now, that since other than the Cosa Nostra, which has been diminished in strength, but they're always going to be organized crime. People do want to gamble. They want to have women. They want things like that, or something you get in the black market. You'll always have that. Look at back, if I may, just digress to World War II, to show how the initiative that organized crime had at that time. They got involved in black market beef. You want sugar, you get stamps for that. Gasoline, whatever it was, they would be able to come forward. So they always fill a void. That's their argument, always been, we give what people want. Now, of course, there's been other inroads of other families, particularly in the Chicago. By families, I mean different factions, different ethnic groups.
Which ethnic groups?
Well, number one, of course, we have the black street gangs. At one time, the outfit controlled the South and West Sides. That's not the case anymore. The El Rukins, of course, were a powerful outfit under Jeff Fort. The government would put a lot of squeeze on them.
That Fort still runs it for prison.
That's where the contention has been. And then you have the
gangs. And he's been in prison for 15 years.
Yes, almost that. Yes, he has. But that's the same argument that the government has given as far as the Cosa Nostra here in town is the outfit with James Marcello, who's been incarcerated since 2005 at the Metropolitan Correctional Center. And as of last fall, I was told by the authorities that they believe that he's still calling the shots. So it can be done up to a degree. I remember when Iupa went to jail. We're talking about a man by the name of Joey Doves Iupa back, who was convicted back in the late 80s. And he was still calling the shots for some time.
There are East European gangs or outfits.
Right, of course, in New York.
Taken over a good deal of activity, haven't they?
First of all, you have, of course, the Russian gangs were big in New York.
Yeah.
And they use old-fashioned stuff.
Home right, ground of Brooklyn.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Now, how much activity have they been in the Chicago area? I think they're here. We do know this. There's been some cases women that have been brought in, if you could call them white slaves, brought in from the Baltic states to work in some of these gentlemen's clubs. And there were several cases where individuals were convicted in federal court of prostitution-related charges. And those were people from the old Soviet Union area.
Now, hold on a minute. When you speak of gentlemen's clubs, you mean nightclubs which are legal, in which there's a lot of nude dancing.
That's correct. Strip joints, we used to call them, but things are getting everybody sophisticated. You don't
strip
use
joints.
That name anymore. Exotic dancing.
But they're within the range of the law.
Yeah.
But possibly many of those strippers are also rendering prostitution service.
That's what a lot of people contend. I'm not going to pinpoint any certain club. Some clubs are above board. Others, obviously, that goes on. You can go in the back room, you get whatever.
And is the ownership of those places essentially East European?
I don't know the licensees who all of them are, but some of them are. Yes, they are. Eastern European. Also, there was a few years back, I noticed the authorities uncovered a stolen auto ring with mostly Polish nationals were involved in. It was organized as well. You also had, I remember one time, the Hillbilly Mafia. You saw it, different groups we were called.
I never heard of that one.
You heard a big group, of course, with the Mexican cartels as far as drug dealing. I remember the group that came in, what we call the Notorious Herrera family. Even in the 70s, were bringing up from Durango in Mexico, who supplied the heroin to the Chicago area at that time. That group was pretty well busted up. But the street gangs, you mentioned El Rukins. You have the Gangster Disciples have been hurt, but that was a man by the name of Hoover that led that group. You have the Latin Kings. You have other street gangs. And I think lots of the homicides that have occurred in Chicago, I think would be accurate to say, have been gang-related from one group faction fighting another.
So that's why we got a big boost in number of murders last year.
You had over 500, which is higher than the past. But you have other street gangs. You have the Chinese. Remember, we have the Ghost Shadows. We have the Chinese street gangs. You have almost invariably many ethnic groups that have street gangs. How organized they are, how efficient they are compared to the old Cosa Nostra is another story.
There are sociologists who opined years ago in a few famous papers that this sort of gang activity, this sort of gang crime is really, quote, a sociological word, highly functional. That is, it serves needs. It's part of, in a way, it's part of the mechanics of a real society. Some activities are ruled out by law, whether wisely or unwisely, but if they are activities that people want to partake in all the same, whether it's prostitution, whether it's illegal gambling, whether it's buying bootleg liquor a long time ago when you couldn't buy liquor legally in the 1920s in this country, those are services that need to be rendered. Also, getting loans that you couldn't get from a bank because you're not trustworthy enough for the banks. So that's juice loans. But all of this is service rendered by the gangs, and it keeps the society going at certain levels.
That was the same argument that you heard from Al Capone in 1929, probably. We provide goods and services to the people that want them. I recall covering a trial around, I think it was either 69 or 70, of a juice loan trial group called the Anarino Gang. And one of the people that testified for the government was a man from Glencoe who could not get a loan through normal channels in any of the banks, lending institutions, because he didn't have collateral. He made a loan, and he was going up and paying off a guy at a hot dog stand. Now, there was goods and services there, by the way. And that's what they contend they provide. That juice loan, was, despite the fact that interest rates are high, we're taking care of somebody. That way, at least we give them money.
We are due for a quick round of news updates, and then back to John Drummond and into the book, the wonderful book, It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real, some great stories.
All right.
And I put you on notice, sir. I want to talk about the Man of Steel when we return. Who he is will be revealed right after the update on the news from Jim Good. And we return to Bulldog John Drummond. Who was the Man of Steel? You've got a chapter on him in the wonderful book, It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real.
Well, he was not the chairman of U.S. Steel, if that some of your listeners may assume.
Tony, nor was he Joseph Stalin.
No, he was not. Right. That's correct. He was a man by the name of, actually, Anthony Florian Zaleski was his real name. He changed it to fight by the name of Tony Zale. And they called him the Man of Steel because he came from Gary, Indiana. And he had a body like steel. He was in great shape physically, a hard puncher.
Was he a middleweight?
He was a middleweight champion of the world. In 1941, he became the champion, actually 1940, and then he went into service, came back out, and by that time he had to fight a fellow by the name of Rocky Graziano, who of course had made a big hit with the New York crowd by beating up on welterweights. And they had three great fights, one of them in Chicago Stadium here, by the way, one that Graziano won, and then Zale won the third one in New Jersey. My point, one of the points of that book I always wanted to make, Rocky Graziano was a man who had captured the imagination of aficionado in New York. He was a guy that got kicked out of the Army, a dishonorable discharge. His other playmate, Jake LaMotta, of course, made a fortune in his book, The Raging Bull. They made a movie out of it after his book, former middleweight champion. He was another guy that had trouble. Went in the tank, in other words, threw a fight against Billy Fox in the Garden in 1947. These guys had bad reps. And yet these were the guys that made them, that became national figures. They were playing, they had on television, on radio, in the movies, and that type of stuff. And Zale was a straight arrow guy. Never involved in anything like that, and he never got the credit he deserved until he married his second wife, Philomena, a former baseball player, by the way, when they had that baseball league in World War II. And she was a pusher and tried to get Tony some ink, give him some publicity and things like that, and she did quite a well for him, and then she died, and that was pretty tough. But here was a guy who followed. In other words, here was a guy who followed the golden rule. Colorful fighter because he could hit hard. He KO'd Zale Graziano twice, by the way, and never got, I felt, the credit that was due. Straight arrow guy, never threw a fight, never got any trouble, and bang.
Well, to get along, you've got to go along.
Yeah, I guess so. See, that's it. Life isn't fair.
Yeah. And that sport, boxing, was certainly
at that time it was heavily controlled by organized crime figures. No question about it.
So you had to know
guy.
Throw the fight when they told you to throw,
throw
the fight.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. What happened to Zale?
Well, Zale later got a job with Ed Kelly, who, of course, is the Park District boss, got him a job as a boxing instructor with the Chicago Park District. And he did work quite a bit with him there. He tried a restaurant like a lot of these fellows did. He had a restaurant here in Chicago on the street. It folded. And then he went to New York as a greeter at a steakhouse called Gallagher's. He came back. That's when he married Philomena, came back here, and Kelly got him his job instructing young men, which was excellent because in his day, as he pointed out, Zale did, that is, he wasn't trying to teach people to become professional fighters. Get them off the street, give them some exercise, try to follow himself like the golden rule he had.
Before your time and before my time in Chicago, but I knew of him when I was a kid, and my father was very enthusiastic for him. Another great boxer in Chicago, Barney Ross.
Yes, former Marine.
Yeah.
That's right. He was the former lightweight champion of the world. And, of course, went in Marines at not a young age. It was in Guadalcanal, I think, he was wounded.
And fought seriously.
Yes, he did. And then he got a drug habit because of that. And he had to be, I think he was down at Lexington, Kentucky, and was treated there. And that because of that, he became a cause celeb. Barney Ross is quite a fighter. You bet he is one of the better fighters in Chicago. He and Zale were probably the two best fighters to come out of here.
Among the Jewish boxing enthusiasts back in New York when I was a kid, immigrant fathers of native-born sons in Brooklyn and thereabouts, there was great interest in Jewish fighters. So Barney Ross was one that they cared about a great deal. Another was a guy named King Levitsky. Have you ever
heard
that name?
Yes, he did. Heavyweight.
Yeah. And then, fighting in New York, or as they say, out of New York, a non-Jewish guy named Max Baer. The name was actually of German origin.
Livermore, California. He was part, but he wore the Star of David on his trunks.
Exactly.
Because he realized, they said, hey, it's a gimmick. We'll get the Jewish,
exactly,
Jewish
so.
To come to see you.
Exactly so. You know all about everything.
Well, I followed. Boxers, that was it. Well, they had a lot of great Jewish fighters. And one was a Chicago guy by the name of Davy Day was popular. You had New York guys like Al Bummy Davis, Benny Leonard, a great lightweight champion.
Yeah.
A lot of great Jewish fighters. And as you pointed out, Max Baer had the moniker of the king.
Pseudo-Jew.
But I think he was that, yes.
Let's go back to this great book of yours, It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real. It's published by Evanston Publishers, who are based someplace else.
In Louisville, Kentucky.
How do you account for that?
Well, they moved on there. They were originally.
They were.
That's why, yeah. They didn't change their name.
Well, Hail Caesar is the title of another chapter involving two interesting fellows.
That's referring to a man, obviously not Julius Caesar, we're not told. We didn't go back that far. We've been around a while, not quite back then. But that's referring to a man by the name El Taco. They call him Caesar Taco. He was the mob boss in the south suburbs. He got into trouble, and he fled to Greece. And the authorities put pressure on the Greek government to get kicked out. And according to Mr. Taco, he left something like $500,000 of money in a flower pot when he got thrown out of his apartment in Athens and came to get him. Well, if true that is, I don't know. He came back here. He was the type of guy, if you did a lot of organized crime stories, he was the guy that hated to be photographed. We said it would be very difficult to get pictures of him. He had a sandwich shop in the Chicago Heights area. We sent a crew down there one day to get pictures of him. He spotted the crew, put on a Groucho Marx disguise, and was at the grill doing that. He'd do anything to avoid pictures. When he'd get him on the street, he'd put a sheet over his head and run like grease lightning. But he was quite a character. He died at the Terre Haute Penitentiary. He went to jail. And by the way, had one funny incident in that story about El Taco. And we're going back to the Spilatros now. It came out in his trial that his wife testified that they were scheduled to have a party that night, or going to have some people over for grilling. And I think that Mr. Taco couldn't make it because he had an important assignment. He had to help bury the Spilatro brothers. His wife picked him up, and if it's true or not, we don't know. He and several other individuals were called upon by the organized crime people here to do the burial of the Spilatro brothers in Morocco, Indiana. This, of course, refutes again anything that came out in the movie and the book Casino.
Mm-hmm.
He came back, according to his wife, terrified when he found out later that the authorities had found that a farmer had dug it up, and the authorities found that the bodies of the two men, the two Spilatro brothers. He was concerned that he had botched the job, that he was going to be killed. But apparently he had a meeting with Joe Ferriol and others, and he said there was nothing to worry about. And so El Taco died of natural causes in a prison, I believe, in Terre Haute, Indiana. But he was the racket's boss down in the Chicago Heights area, succeeded a man by the name of El Pilato, who, by the way, was shot on a golf course. Could be anything bad as that. He wasn't killed, but playing golf and getting shot is criminal. There, everything would be.
How many of these guys live out their normal term of years and die in bed?
In Chicago, quite a few do. Tony Accardo did. Joseph Ayupa did. Jack Cerrone did. Those are the leadership people. Sam Carlisi did. And very few of them were executed in Chicago. There's been a lot of people murdered, but they weren't necessarily the top guy, other than Sam Giancana. Maybe Chucky Nicoletti that was killed would be high echelon. I'm trying to think of anybody else that was that high. Well, you have a man that disappeared in August of 06 by the name of Anthony Zizzo. He's a little 5'3" guy. He was from Westmont, who went to jail on gambling charges with Jimmy Marcello back in the early 90s, and was considered a fairly high-ranking guy. Now, he vanished. His car was found. He left his home in Westmont in August of 06, and his car was seen at a Belrose Park restaurant. It's found there, abandoned. And that's the last anybody's seen of Mr. Zizzo. He's vanished. So he apparently has met with foul play.
The favorite reporter of Chicago cops is John Drummond.
Oh, I don't like to say that, but...
Lots of people tell me that, and cops will tell you that.
One time, maybe not, obviously, now. So much.
Well, okay. But you still have that reputation. You were a cops reporter. They cared for you. They respected you. They talked to you. They talked to you more than they talked to anybody, any others of your competing colleagues, I'm sure. What was your connection with the cops?
Well, we did so many police stories from the beginning, not just in...
But how did you hit it off so well with them?
Well, maybe I was a little older. Maybe I could see their point of view. I think they trusted me. They felt that after they got to know me, that I wasn't going to spill the beans. If they said something, this is confidential, do this, that, then I wasn't going to tattle on them. I think I gained that respect, and word spreads fast about that. So I think that was the main reason that they respected me, because I respected them. And we had that, I think that's accurate to say that.
You spent an awful lot of time in station houses around the town.
We did. We covered a lot. That's right. A lot of the stuff we were involved in doing that. Yes, and some of the times we had police stories that didn't put them in a good light. I'm referring to many a trial that we covered, including the group in the Chicago District, the Avenue District, the Austin District, and, of course, the case involving Mr. Hanart not too long ago.
We had the Summerdale.
That happened in I would not. That happened
that's
in
a
April
long time
1960.
Ago.
Yes, it was, and that of course brought in O.W. Wilson. That was the first big scandal. But yet, the Summerdale scandal was not the biggest as far as the amount of policemen. I recall, in Chicago Avenue District, which is the district which then was located right up here on Chicago Avenue, which encompassed the Gold Coast as well as Cabrini Green. In the early 70s, 23 police officers, including the man who was at that time the head of traffic, were indicted for shaking down taverns, tavern owners, which was a bigger group than the Summerdale group. Then you had the similar type thing happening over in the Austin district, where a man by the name of Mark Thanosaurus was the captain there, a man who was on the way up, and by the way, was murdered by the mob. Later on.
Something we've been preoccupied with on this program for the last few weeks is essentially political corruption. It has a great deal to do with the Blagojevich issue or Blagojevich scandal, but there's evidence all over the place of politicians being bought or politicians soliciting money under the table or soliciting it for favors that they will then deliver. Pay to play has become the operative descriptive phrase. I know that you've followed that a great deal in the past, and you're following it in the present. When we return, some commercials coming up, a bit overdue, I'd love to get your thoughts about the extent of and the depth of political corruption in Chicago these days. Directly back to John Drummond after this. And directly back to John Drummond. So it's the topic of the month, the topic of the week, still the topic of the day. Namely, political corruption in Chicago. That is all symbolized by the governor, still sitting governor of the state of Illinois. What thoughts do you have about Mr. Blagojevich?
Well, I think that, let's face reality, any time usually the federal government, at least in recent years, presents a case, in his case it's a criminal informational, they're trying to seek an indictment against him, the government, federal government, has a pretty high batting average of convictions.
Something like 95%.
It's very high. So obviously he has got to figure, among his other problems right now, is he probably will be indicted, that he's got to put some, get some something in his backup that he's going to need when it comes to trial.
He can look forward to possibly being his cellmate of George Ryan.
There's indeed. Well, George Ryan, if Mr. Ryan is not pardoned by President Bush, that could happen. Although he's in Terre Haute. That's usually not what my politicians go to Oxford or Duluth as a general rule. I think that the governor, in my opinion, two things he did in appointing Roland Burris to that position of the U.S. Senate. One, I think he wanted to show that he's the governor, I think, and that he can do what he wants, and that's his job, and I'll do it. Take it or leave it. And he probably will see. I mean, I think Mr. Burris will be seated. But the other thing I think that he did, I think he had an eye out to the time that he's going to be on trial, assuming that he's going to probably go on trial. And he realizes that jury pool could have a number of African Americans. By coming out as he had, supporting Roland Burris, and having Mr. Bobby Rush up there also supporting him in that way, I think that made sense for him in the sense that he has a better chance of possibly winning out.
And did the leader of the Senate majority, Harry Reid, Senator Reid, did he help him inadvertently by sending him a communication which has been disclosed, a communication saying, I don't want Danny Davis, I don't want Jesse Jackson Jr., I don't want Emil Jones, I want either Tammy Duckworth or
two white females, Lisa Madigan.
Or Lisa Madigan.
That's exactly right.
I reject all the blacks.
I can be cynical on that. Maybe I'm wrong in Blagojevich doing that, but I think you can't help but not think that that was, I mean, and the guy's a skillful politician, and you can't help but not think
totally,
Chicago style.
Not totally skillful.
No, okay, well, that's right. He hasn't been convicted yet, but I think he thinks of those things. I think that's certainly an issue, and I'm sure that gave him some consideration.
Of course, political scandal, as we've been saying on this program in recent discussions, is really part of our tradition. The case that most stunned me when it first emerged, and when I think of it still, I don't quite understand how you could have had corruption running so deep and into such quarters, the quarters being the judicial system of the County of Cook.
Was the Graylord case. That was the Graylord case back in 1982. There's something like 80 courtroom personnel were charged in that case, including, I believe, 16 judges. One judge was acquitted. That was all.
16 were convicted.
That's right. Was that a fifth or whatever the case? And it had spring later, of course, with Maloney and some of those were outlet of the Graylord case. I think that was the most stunning thing.
These were judges who did what exactly?
Well, most of them were. Well, some of them were in traffic, like Lefevre. Some of them were in traffic.
They took bribes.
That's exactly right. You had some with narcotics, like Wayne Olson, and then you had Tom Maloney, who actually presided on murder cases.
And forgave murders.
That was the highest one. Yeah. And he had somebody over in the Chancery Division. He had several that were convicted over there at the Daily Center. So it was wide-ranging in that sense. And it was a national story at the time. It was shocking to hear that these judges were taking bribes. People, of course, very cynical before figuring out what was going on. But it came out publicly that it was.
Well, John, what's your best guess, and it's only a guess, does that still happen in our judicial system at all?
I'm sure it's been reduced a lot, but to say it's been completely eliminated, I wish I could say it has been. I wonder about that.
And does it still happen on the police force, cops taking bribes?
Oh, yes, there's no question about it. Unfortunately, there's a few that are always going to do that.
Is it only a few?
Well, it's more than a few, I guess, when you come right down to it. But it's not certainly, they're certainly in a very small minority. But no matter what they, first, I'll tell you one thing. I think one of the reasons, in my opinion, now, you're talking to me about white-collar corruption, about judges, courtroom personnel, politicians going to jail. I've contended this before. I think one of the reasons that most of the individuals, when they do time, they do it at these camps, where their individual, their cellmates or their clientele with them are people in the same socioeconomic background. They don't have to worry like they do at Pontiac or Stateville, walking down the night to take a shower, that somebody's going to grab you. I think that's not a deterrent. Obviously, the judges don't have any control over that. That's up to the Bureau of Prisons. We have to, obviously, if you're going to make that kind of crime, a white-collar crime, more severe, you have to have it be done by the legislature. But I've seen so many judges say, I want to send a message. We want to send a message. We're going to stop this wrongdoing. But it hasn't stopped. It continues and continues and continues.
Then the other group that's constantly accused of taking money under the table, looking for money that by which others who need services or need contracts or need something or other have to pay to play. The other group accused very often of being deeply involved in that sort of thing is politicians themselves, not only the governor of the state of Illinois, but legislators and county officials and what have you.
We had powerful aldermen like Tom Keene was head of the finance committee. That's what I mean. He was certainly one of the big figures there. We had
some 30 aldermen or more over the last 20 or 30 years.
Thompson, when Thompson became the prosecutor.
Some 30 over 30 years have gone to prison.
That's right.
Like one a year.
That's right. And they get fooled every time. It's corruption deals. Usually there's somebody wearing a wire, and they get hooked on it just the same. There's one case, amusing, one case, one of the few that got acquitted, was a county board case by the name of Charles Bonk, I remember, who was represented by Tom Ferran, a former U.S.
Bonk?
Attorney. Bonk, B-O-N-K.
Great
name. He was under corruption charges. And believe it or not, he never took the stand. There were no witnesses hardly for him. And when the jury came in, he was acquitted. And afterwards, I heard what the reason was, that Bonk was dressed always poorly every day. His suit looked like it was a sack. And so the jury figured, if this guy was taking bribes and taking money, it can't be. He dresses like a bum, for God's sakes. And so he got acquitted.
Well, I guess very few of us are angels.
No. The temptation also, you mentioned the police. We said before that fortunately it's not, there's a few, but more than that, I guess, when you come right down to it.
The great philosophical question that emerges, though, is, does everyone have a threshold beyond which he or she can be corrupted? Or are there corruptible types and straight arrow types and never the twain shall blend?
Well, I think everybody's got a little larceny in them, I'm afraid. And the temptation is what? There's so-called straight arrow types that have fooled a lot of people, have gone to jail and been involved in wrongdoing.
You know, the con games and confidence men who practice a kind of special art. I once read a wonderful book by a guy named David Maurer called The Big Con. He was a linguist who got involved in studying the language of con men, and that got him all the more involved in the nature of the games, and he began to investigate those, and he began to look at that whole subculture of the confidence rackets, where there were some stars. One of them was a great Chicago figure, Yellow Kid Wild, way back at the beginning, I think, of the 19th century. But one thing he quotes, David Maurer does in the book The Big Con, is this basic precept that a mark, meaning a victim, has to have a, quote, well-developed sense of larceny.
That's a good point. And by the way, it happens in the radio industry, too, Bill. Remember the payola scandals years back, where disc jockeys were taking money to play certain records.
Yeah.
So it's not isolated to politicians, police, and public figures.
Happens everywhere.
It happens everywhere.
It happens in the church.
That's right.
If they don't go after money, they may go after something else.
That's correct.
And we know some troubles of that sort that have emerged in recent years. What are the great stories that you still haven't committed to print?
Well, actually, I think the biggest...
You must have another book in you.
Yeah, yes, there is. But this, I think the most traumatic thing, when I think I was working still at WIND at the time, but I think the most moving stories that affected me the most, believe it or not, were the disturbance of the riots after Dr. King was assassinated, April 68, and then we had the police disturbances. I mean, convention disturbances
in
August of 1968, the convention, followed that by the Days of Rage in the fall of 1969.
Yeah.
I thought at one time, I'll be honest with you, particularly not after the King riots, but in the situation in August, I thought that this country was on the verge of revolution. I really felt that to be the case. I was really taken in by that.
You were down there in 68 at the convention.
I was never inside. I was out twice, two nights.
In front of the hotel.
In front of the hotel, not Wednesday. That night I was in when they had the last Battle of Michigan Avenue. I was there first night, was I think of a Monday night when they surrounded the statue of General Logan. I recall what triggered that. I was up in Lincoln Park where they're having a rally, that is the Haydens and those groups, and the police, Dick's car came up, and they grabbed Hayden and another guy and took him down to police headquarters. The group then marched, the group of protesters, and marched all the way to police headquarters and then went over to the Logan statue where they climbed up on top of that thing. That started, that really started the violence.
And did you in those days meet Bernardine Dorn or Bill Ayers?
No, but I met Rennie Davis. I did a half-hour interview with Rennie Davis, and I interviewed Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers, I interviewed in front of, this was now, I was in 1969 when I was working for Channel 2. Mm-hmm. I interviewed Bill Ayers in front of the criminal court's building in the fall of 1969, and I recall...
That was before he went underground.
That's correct. We could not use the interview because there was too many obscenities and swearing that he used at that time. He seemed to be an arrogant young man. Of course, his father was very well-to-do. All of these, a lot of these guys were very well-to-do.
Well, his father was the head of...
Commonwealth Edison.
Commonwealth Edison.
And you recall Man Flanagan, the man that tackled, that grappled with Rich Elrod when they had the Days of Rage.
He broke his spine.
That's correct. And then he went on trial. I'll never forget the day that he walked out of the criminal courts building. That is, we're talking to this man Flanagan, on whatever the charges were, stemming a riot, whatever it was, and he was acquitted. And he came out there, and I recall, put up that power fist, that which was a national picture, and I recall it very well because the cameraman we had at that time missed the picture.
How does it strike you that that Bernardine Dorn is now a professor in the law school at Northwestern, and that Bill Ayers is a supposedly distinguished professor of education at UIC?
I'm not that wild about it. I know that people, of course, can change. And that may, and apparently, Ayers and Dorn may be doing good things to people now. I don't know. But they never really, to me, came forward and actually expressed any kind of sorrow for what they did at that time. I think they feel that was justified, what they did.
Well, Ayers is on a mission to radicalize young Americans through education. The books that he writes talk about the social injustice that is common to American life and how that must be taught through the public schools. That's when he isn't going down to Venezuela to give speeches endorsing the operations of Hugo Chavez. Yet there are those who feel that he is not merely fully redeemed, but in fact renders very significant social service, and indeed the University of Illinois.
Obviously they feel that way, and UIC feels that way, that they've done that thing. That's why I indicated, apparently he's doing, quote, good things. But he has never renounced his past. Of course, he can say, no, wait a minute, why should he renounce it? Because he feels that we've involvement in Vietnam was wrong, and so on and so forth. I just don't think the means that they took was good.
Which other radicals of that period did you have encounter with?
Well, I saw, I mean, like Dellinger and those guys.
You must have been to that trial.
Actually, my job then, because I had started it, when the trial started, I was not, I was outside on the street all the time.
Yeah.
So I was not in the courtroom at that case.
What was the name of the judge? I'm trying to remember.
Hoffman.
Of course, Julius Hoffman.
That's correct.
Yeah. The Chicago 7.
That's correct. The Chicago 7.
Yeah.
Now, that was a big story at the time. It also, by the way, it was unique also for television in the sense it showed that the TV could cover a trial with an artist, something they hadn't done before.
Gee, those were exciting days.
Yes, they were. They were very exciting days, and they're not like that now.
What was the busiest year of your life?
Oh, I think when I started Channel 2 at that time, that 69-70 period, because there were so many disturbances. I remember the Indians took over the Nike site, long hours, that type of thing.
Remember that.
Yeah, they had a Nike site up here in Lincoln Park, and the Indians took
over. Oh, I thought you meant sneakers. You mean real Nikes.
That's right. Oh, yeah, not
missiles.
That's right, missile site. That's correct. They were there for several days. I remember that more than that. Things like that were going on all the time. People don't realize, and a lot of stress in the high schools at that time. We were down at the school so much where you had, particularly in inner city, where a lot of African Americans were objecting because the leadership of the schools at that time were white principals, and so that changed. We had a lot of violence then too.
John, I am going to pause in just a moment for an update on the news, but I do want to say right now that we want to go to the phones directly thereafter. So the lines are open, 591-7200. Any question you want to raise, any comment you want to make to the great John Drummond, now's the time to get in there quickly. 591-7200, and as the calls accumulate, we hope to go directly to you after the update on the news, and that comes right now from Jim Gooders. It is no surprise that everybody wants to talk to John Drummond tonight, just as I want to get him in here as often as I can. John's newest book, published only last year, It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real, some of the stories from his beat. And we're going to go directly to the phones and to the email. And that's been accumulating as well, though I hadn't yet invited email. For phone calls, 591-7200. At the moment, of course, all the lines are taken, but you can get in there if you try again when we say goodnight to a prior caller. For email, extension 720 at Tribune.com. And directly to the first caller, Bob in Naperville. Good evening.
Good evening. I remember in the mid-80s, one of the street gangs, I think it was the El Rukins, were trying to get in touch with the Muammar Gaddafi in Libya for weapons. How close did they get, and how scary could have it been?
That was a big story at the time. The listener is referring to the fact that Jeff Fort et al. Supposedly were getting weapons from Libya that they could use, buying weapons from Libya. I think it was a phony deal, if I recall, and I have a chapter in the book about that, incidentally, that one of the FBI or an ATF man was worked undercover. And as a result of that, led to the arrest of these guys. I don't think they ever contacted Mr. Gaddafi, but the government was contending that the authorities were contending that indeed they were trying to negotiate with the Libyans to get bazookas and other weapons of that nature. So it was serious by their attack.
What were they planning to do with those bazookas?
That's a good question. Obviously something illegal. Terrify their rival gangs, perhaps, or even pull a bank job. Who knows?
Huh. Sarah, thank you for the call, and directly to another on 591-7200. John in Franklin Park. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm sorry. You know, I was curious. When Giancana got taken out, who do you think was involved in that?
Well, we talked about that earlier tonight, sir.
The other thing I already mentioned, he asked who actually was involved. The authorities, nobody will know for sure. Nobody was ever indicted.
I mean, where'd the orders come from?
But, yeah, the orders obviously came from Ricardo Diupa.
Right.
I believe it, Dominic Butch Blasi was the name of the figure that most people feel was involved in it.
I'd heard another name that I didn't know I was going to be on the air. It was Tony
Spalak?
B.
Tony who?
It began with a B.
Butch Blasi.
No, Borsellino.
Tony Borsellino, who I think was killed. I never heard his name surfacing in connection with the Giancana murder. No.
We thank the caller. We'll go quickly to another on 591-7200 and to Tony in Atlanta, Georgia. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg, and good evening, Mr. Drummond. I'll tell you what, I have been a media voyeur all my life, and Mr. Drummond, I watched you when I lived in Chicago, and here I am in Atlanta, and I do miss your reporting.
Do you miss the crime in Chicago, too?
Actually, I've got my own share of it here in Atlanta. So, you know, one equals another, I guess. My question for you, Mr. Drummond, is this. What do you think was the most fascinating story that you covered? What do you think was the greatest accomplishment that you've had in your esteemed journalistic career? I mean, they broke the mold when, they made you. I mean, the media is not today what it used to be when you were coming up through the ranks.
Well, you're very kind to call me esteemed. Number one, there's been so many stories. Obviously, I mentioned earlier the 1968 disturbances, which was very traumatic and quite a thing to cover because it was so unique and had nothing like that ever had since here in Chicago. I would say that one of the most exciting stories, interesting stories, was Helen Voorhees Brock, the Lendry woman, the heiress to the Brock candy fortune,
sure,
who vanished in 1977, whose body has never been found. That, to me, is it's a story that's continuing. Nobody's ever been charged in that. It's a great mystery. We have our views as who was involved, but that story goes down as unsolved.
Let me read something to you, an email I've got in front of me on that very issue, which says, my question has to do with one of Chicagoland's most celebrated mysteries, the disappearance of Helen Brock, the candy heiress. We know that a man named Bailey was finally convicted for conspiracy to commit murder in the case. Does John think that the authorities got it right? And I've never heard a convincing explanation of the suspicious activities of Brock's, quote, houseman. What role did he play, if any?
All right, let's go back to the Helen Voorhees Brock case. This is always, it seems, every time people have that, and it is.
It's the classic case.
Yes, it is. A man by the name of Richard Bailey, who was romantically involved with Helen Voorhees Brock, went on trial in 1995 on conspiracy charges. He was the man that the government contended had wooed some of these wealthy widows on the North Shore, sold them horses that weren't worth a darn, that should have been in a glue factory, but got good prices for them. In other words, he was a swindler. He was romancing Mrs. Brock. In fact, they dined and danced to the music of Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians at New Year's Eve in December 1976. But the story was the authorities felt that she was ready to blow the whistle. She realized she's being taken in by Bailey and was going to indeed go to the authorities and tell them what he was doing. Well, she, of course, when Bailey found out about that, he went to other people. She was taken away and was murdered. There's no question about that. Bailey himself, later on in 1995, went on trial at the Dirksen Federal Building on charges of conspiracy and also shaking down these women, extorting money. He is now incarcerated, still in a prison, the last I heard, down in Florida. He'd be a man now who would be probably 79 years old. But he never was charged directly with being involved in the murder at all. But since you bring this up, we're going to discuss it one more time. According to the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division, this is what happened. John Rotunno, a very, very capable agent, feels this was the case. That his information came in turn from a man who was a Joe Plemons, who was a horseman and a trainer. So the whole story depends on how valid you believe Plemons' story. According to Plemons, that Mrs. Brock had a physical. She had it at the Rochester Mayo Clinic. We know that in 1977. According to Plemons, that she was driven back to her house in Glenview by her houseman, Jack Matlick, and another man who was a suburban police officer. According to Plemons, when they arrived in Glenview, she was beaten to death, beaten badly. And they put her in the trunk of her Cadillac and drove down to either to Tinley Park or Orland Park to a horse farm owned by a man by the name of Hanson, Richard Hanson, Kenneth Hanson, as you were. At that time, when they arrived on the scene, according to Plemons, they opened the trunk, and Mrs. Brock was moaning. Plemons said that he was ordered by one of the henchmen there to put the coup de grace on Mrs. Brock, and he had no choice but to shoot her, or he would have been killed. And then, according to Plemons, the body was taken and was evaporated, so to speak, incinerated at a steel mill in East Chicago, Indiana. That's the story that Joe Plemons gave. The ATF, the federal authorities, thinks that's a pretty good story. However, the state's attorney's office felt they could not have enough evidence to charge anybody with that murder or that disappearance of Mrs. Brock, because they didn't think Plemons was that credible. And so the case remains unsolved today. According to Plemons, the people involved were, of course, Richard Matlick, the houseman, and a suburban police officer, and Hanson, and Hanson's brother Curtis, who's now deceased. How true that story is, I don't know. Matlick, by the way, is living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. He'd be a man about 78 years old. He has never been charged with any wrongdoing and denies he had anything to do with Mrs. Brock's death. But the authorities have always felt he knows what happened. Whether he was involved or not is another story.
It's worth remembering that the writ of habeas corpus, if interpreted literally, means having the body.
Yeah, that's right.
And the Brock is a famous case where there is no, where non habeas corpus. Another such famous case, not in Chicago, is the former head of the...
James Hoffa, you're referring
to. James
Hoffa,
yes. The former head of the Auto Workers Union.
Who disappeared in 1975, and some people think he was buried beneath Giant Stadium in Rutherford, New Jersey.
We've got lots of folklore about where.
Yes, we have.
What happened to his body.
That's correct.
Yeah. It's time for us to stop, if only briefly, for a quick round of messages. Then directly back to the phones, 591-7200, and to email extension 720 at tribune.com. And directly back to the great John Drummond. What are you doing these days in television?
Well, I haven't done very much. I haven't been working, of course, at Channel 2 until last year. We do a few things freelancing, that we can do that.
What's your freelance?
Well, we'll give you a couple. We did one, for example, the National Geographic did a very nice thing on the Chicago mob. That's on cable, of course. That was all early this year. We worked on that for several days. And,
now, you say we worked on it. What do you do?
I think it's also as giving information, mm-hmm. exchanging views, and then doing interviews for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
That part of it. The same with we did a piece on Anthony Spilotro that appeared once. It'll be coming back again. I saw something they did the other day, by the way, on Tony Accardo. So these things do come up there periodically.
Any Hollywood films in the offing?
No.
You are a major character in the great film, The Fugitive.
Yeah, I was in that. Unfortunately, Hollywood has not been calling. As you were. But there is a movie that I was in that has not yet been released.
What is that?
It's about Chester Rocky Uyghur. To recall your audience, that Chester Uyghur was a dishwasher at Starbrook Lodge when three women from suburban Riverside were murdered. Mm-hmm. In March of that year, a very big, highly publicized case. He was charged, convicted, and, of course, he had been fighting. He recanted his confession, and that's the story about Uyghur. Did he get railroaded? Did he get framed or not? That's
Are you yourself?
Yes, this is a documentary type of thing. Yes,
through a documentary.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Most of your appearances have been as yourself.
Yes, that's correct. No nude roles, nothing like that.
Well, we still have that.
Yeah, of course.
In the offing, I trust. Here's an email for you. I believe that Mr. Ross, this is Barney Ross, who became a drug addict while serving in the Army during World War II, was the inspiration for Frankie Machine, the anti-hero of Nelson Algren's The Man with the Golden Arm. Did Mr. Drummond ever encounter Algren in the local police stations, which the author was known to frequent in search of stories?
No, I did not. I've never met Nelson Algren at all. That was a little before my time. And I do remember The Man with the Golden Arm made into a movie with Frank Sinatra taking the part of Frankie Machine.
Yeah.
Whether that had anything stemmed from the Ross case. And by the way, Ross was not in the Army. He was in the Marines where he was wounded in Guadalcanal.
And back to the phones. 591-7200. And we go to Mike in Chicago. Good evening.
Good evening. I'd like to ask Mr. Drummond if he sees any similarities in Richard D. Daley's hiring of Orlando Wilson as police superintendent in the 1960s and Richard M. Daley's appointment of Jody Weiss. From what I was told, I was a child when Wilson was the superintendent, that Richard J. Daley appointed Wilson as window dressing with the intent that he would run the police department himself, not realizing that Wilson, although a renowned criminologist, had in fact run police departments much earlier in his career in California. And I have had my doubts of Mr. Weiss's ability in that area. I was just wondering if Mr. Drummond would have any comments.
Well, the similarities are this. The similarities are both Wilson and Weiss were outsiders. Wilson, of course, a criminologist from the University of California, Berkeley. Weiss, an FBI man from Philadelphia. So they both, that fact, the only two outsiders to have held the Chicago Police Department, at least in my time. They both came in after scandals in connection. The Wilson came in 1960 after the so-called Summerdale police scandal, and Weiss came in after a number of incidents, including an elite group that was involved in supposedly a crack elite group cracking down on narcotics, and they were involved in dealings with pushers and were getting money in return. That's the only similarity to it. I don't think there's anything like that. I don't think that Daley felt that he could control Wilson, I think, to a degree. And I think maybe he did, because Wilson was a neophyte in dealing with a big major city police department. But Orlando, by the way, went out in 67 with a somewhat distinguished career. But I don't think that Daley really, I think Daley might have had a little control over him, but obviously he didn't have as much control over him as he had the predecessors like Pendergrast and O'Connor and people like that who are local guys.
Let me check something out with you. The most unhappy police chief, as I remember it, and my impressions are certainly fallible, and I didn't have your on-the-scene expertise, but I met this guy a few times, had him on the program a few times, was Joe DeLombardi.
Joe DeLeonardi.
DeLeonardi,
rather. Joe was quite a man.
He was yanked around by Jane Byrne.
What happened was DeLeonardi had carved his niche as a homicide man.
Yeah.
He started out at Area 6, later became homicide commander. Then he was appointed by Jane Byrne as the superintendent.
And she drove him crazy.
And, well, I tell you one thing. I have to admit this, and I may be wrong on this. I think there was a little jealousy between the two, at least with Jane. I recall in the first food fest or whatever, they had that deal down at Navy Pier.
Uh-huh.
And I recall both Mayor Byrne and Superintendent DeLeonardi were there, and people were swarming around DeLeonardi for autographs and things like that.
Yeah.
And we're not supposed to do that with the
he
mayor.
He was a colorful guy.
He was colorful, like Kojak. He had the same type of thing. Yes, he was. And the result, he was later, he later, of course, was devoted, and he also caused quite a bit of consternation when he made some allegations that were covered particularly by the Chicago Tribune about some high-ranking police officers being involved in bed with the mob.
What's happened to him? Do you have any idea?
Joe DeLeonardi, after he left the police department, Joe then became the U.S. Marshal here at Chicago.
Oh.
And he retired from that position. What he's doing today, I don't know. He also collaborated on a book with Richard Whittingham about his experiences some years back.
How has electronic journalism changed over the years that you've been involved in it?
Well, I think like everything else, I think they're leaner and meaner, so to speak. I think there's been some cutbacks. They don't have the staff as much. Although for two, they do have still have their Dave Savini and Pam Zekman involved in their corruption unit, their investigative unit, but they don't have the staff. The staffs have been cut back. There's no question about it. And that's also true with the print as well. It's a sign of the times, unfortunately. The thing is, our numbers are down. The numbers are down, and it costs more to operate than it did, and there's not as much revenue coming.
Do the guys on the crime beat get as close to the cops and as close to the gritty detail of it all as you did?
I don't know if I can't speak for everybody else. Some people certainly have. I think Gowdy does a very good job over at Seven and others like that. But no, because I think now you don't have the opportunity. You don't have the time to develop those stories. You can't work the phones as much as you used to. And that's very important, that working the phones is a way to establish credibility.
How? Explain.
Well, number one, if you come in and have time, that's how you can check. You mentioned some homicide or something. They say, what's new on this case? Or what have we heard this story and that? And you can't do that anymore. You don't have time.
Well, not the phones are still
there. Well, the phones are there, and they're also the cellular now. You're right on that sense. But usually you come in and you say, well, look, this is a great story that we could do today. That sounds good, but we need you because there's been a power failure out in Carroll Stream, or there's a fire down in 47th and Langley. We need you down there. And so you're not able to develop those kind of stories. You don't be able to take a source to lunch or be able to talk to them and things like that.
So it's fewer people covering more stories.
Yes, that's probably it. Yes, it is. Yeah. It's fewer people. Yeah. I think that's a fact of life.
Will Mr. Drummond, I'm reading an email, will Mr. Drummond ever get offered the opportunity to do something unethical or corrupt? Did Mr. Drummond ever get offered the opportunity to do something unethical or corrupt, and what did he do about it?
I don't think, unfortunately, I didn't have that opportunity. I guess nobody.
They never tested.
No, nobody
you.
Came to give me. Well, I take it one time. We did interview a guy, if you could call that in an older era. That, in fact, I'll tell you, was a member of a guy named Libanati, who was a congressman, and of course, allied allegedly with the machine, with the outfit. That we did an interview. I wanted to do a story with him sometime, and when he was done, he said, "How much?" He started bringing out some bills. He said, "How much? What do we got to take care of? How much does this cost?" I said, well, nothing, but we took a lunch for him if that was unethical. But we've had a few cases like that, but that's the extent of it. Unfortunately, nobody bribed me any money to take care of me and things like that.
Do you think that other crime reporters, now dead and gone, have in fact.
Well, I think dead and gone have. I mean, going back to Jake Lingle, if you have to
that's
go back.
That's a famous case.
The famous case where this man was shot by the Bob in 1933.
He worked for the Tribune, didn't he?
He worked for the Tribune, and when he was killed, of course, Colonel McCormick, the legendary head of the Tribune, was outraged that one of his own people had been shot by the Capone organization. And he vowed to bring the people, the perpetrators, to the bar of justice. Well, then he found out, of course, that Lingle was on the payroll. That changed things a bit.
Well, what had Lingle done for them as a journalist?
I don't know whether he tipped off. There's been cases maybe that he tipped off what he did. I think it was very vague at the time what Lingle did. I think he probably tipped off the authorities, or that is Capone people, about what the authorities or the cops are doing, things like that.
Somehow what comes to mind is Godfather 1. It isn't a crooked journalist that gets killed, but it's a crooked cop that gets killed.
That's correct. That portrayed by Sterling Hayden, that's correct.
Yeah.
Well, we had one, Mark Thanasaurus, who was the head of the Austin District and went to jail on corruption charges, captain. And I think at the time, we had a chance, he was a Greek individual, Greek descent. It could have gone really up the ladder in that police department if he hadn't been involved in corrupt activities. He was shot and killed by the mob. So we had one incident here in Chicago like that when he got out, because they thought he was cooperating with the authorities.
So the rule that one is told.
And Bill Drury, going back around 1950, was also killed by the mob, who was making heat on the organization at that time.
But one has heard, obviously incorrectly informed, that a rule by the mob is you never kill a cop.
That's correct, because of the heat they would bring. Also a cop or a newspaper. That's correct. And that's pretty much been true.
But there are exceptions to both.
One exception. I think we brought it up on this program before. There was a case in Arizona by a man by the name of Don Bowles, who was doing a series of corrupt mob stories out there in Phoenix. I think the Arizona Republic. He went to start his automobile, was blown up, and he was killed. And then we had, of course, the case in New York with Victor Reisel, the labor columnist. He was not killed, but a guy came up to him and threw some acid in his face, and he was blinded.
Blinded him.
And last but not least, we have one case here in Chicago, a woman by the name of Molly Zelko, who worked for a Joliet weekly newspaper, who disappeared in 1957 following a series of articles about gambling and racketeering in Will County. They presumed that she met with foul play.
Really? I never heard about that one.
That's the only one.
We're going to go back to the phones and to the email for your questions to our very special guest of the evening, John Drummond, right after an update on the news. And for that, we go, of course, to Jim Goodis. And we go directly back to the phones and down to David in Missouri. Where are you in Missouri?
Leighton, Missouri.
Where's that?
Well, it's east of Kansas City. I'm south of Warrensburg, Missouri, in Johnson County, Missouri.
I see. Well, it's clear that you're a native because you say Missouri.
That's right.
As we say Missouri. But go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to, first of all, for Mr. Drummond, I'd like to congratulate him on his career and having come a long ways from his ancestors digging bog in Scotland and their protection of Mary Queen of Scots when she there was an assassination plot and they was able to keep it from happening, and then later on, 3 years later, she was, but they protected her.
We're getting some of the Drummond ancient family history.
Yeah.
But let's come to the question, sir.
Okay. I'm of an opinion that J. Edgar Hoover's campaign against organized crime and consequent through the years the crackdown on organized crime has led to the increased homicides, like the children being killed on the streets across America in the drug world and other things, that if organized crime had had a greater influence in the communities, keeping it organized rather than unorganized, that there would be a lower degree of
Well, I think we follow that. We follow that hypothesis. Curious though it is, does it strike you as having any possible validity?
No, of course, Hoover, of course, was obsessed with communism, and it wasn't until the Appalachian meeting in November of '57 that he started going after that they really started to hit the outfit, so to speak, or mafia at that time.
Yeah.
But I don't think the outfit. The man's contending, is that it, that organized crime kept a lid on the street crime? Is that it?
That if you left it to organized crime, they would have somehow run a tighter ship, and not as many kids would have died.
Well, I don't know if there'd be any correlation there, although I will admit in communities that the outfit leadership lived in this area, there was very little street crime. So in that case...
In their own neighborhoods.
Yeah, in their own neighborhoods. Yeah. But in a big city like Chicago, I don't think it'd do much good.
Back to the phones and to Bill in Hanover Park. Good evening.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Mr. Drummond, if you could talk very briefly about two characters from the very distant past. The first is Roger Tooley. Do you think he was wrongfully convicted of kidnapping
Jake
Barber? And why did the mob have him killed shortly after he was released? And the second character, I think his name is Richard Kane,
right,
who worked for Richard Ogilvy, who was a crime fighter, known as a crime fighter, when Richard Ogilvy was sheriff, I believe.
That's correct.
Was he like a double agent working for the crime syndicate? Why did Ogilvy hire him? Why did the mob kill him?
All right, sir.
Oh, I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Number one, we're talking about the first case, Roger Tooley. Roger Tooley, I think, was probably railroaded, involving the so-called kidnapping of a con man by the name of Jake the Barber Factor. Number two, he was killed in 1959 after he'd been finally released from the Stateville Penitentiary after serving many years, and he was gunned down on his steps of it. I believe he was living with his sister at the time on the northwest side. He was killed in 1959, and why he was shot, I think that the mob, of course, had a lot of animosity against him, and he was supposedly shot under the orders of Murray the Camel Humphreys. Nobody's ever been charged with Roger Tooley's murder. On the second case, Richard Kane, whose real name was Scalzetti. That's correct. Richard Kane worked for Richard Ogilvy. He was an undersheriff. Ogilvy at the time was a crime fighter. He was a sheriff, later, of course, the county board president and governor. He felt that Kane, who apparently was a very articulate guy and a very persuasive guy, would help him to deal with the outfit. And it turned out, of course, that Kane was working for the mob in that sense. And it became an issue in the 1968 gubernatorial campaign between Ogilvy and Sam Shapiro, that which Shapiro hammered away that Ogilvy had hired a mob guy. It didn't work any difference. However, it turned out that Ogilvy won the race.
John,
Kane was killed, by the way, at a sandwich shop in December 1973.
Yeah, do you know Kane's half-brother? Who was on this program?
He had a book out. That's
a
correct.
Book
I met him last
the Tangled Web. Yeah.
Yes, correct. Richard Kane's brother wrote a book about Kane. That's correct. The Tangled Web, and Kane was killed in December of 73 at a place called Rosa's Sandwich Shop. He came up here. Remember, he was working with Sam Giancana. He was down in Mexico with Giancana, and I think that he came up with a message to Garcia, maybe that Mr. Giancana wasn't welcome back anymore. The Kane case has never been cleared, by the way, as far as who did it.
We'll be back to the phones in just a minute. I do need to do a little bit of business for the program. Most particularly, I need to tell you that a new edition of the blog went up on Friday, and there are a number of interesting articles that we've found which we think you will find amusing or fascinating or stunning. One of them is titled, Should the Obama Generation Drop Out? Charles Murray, a great sociologist who was a guest on this program only a little while ago, wrote that article for the New York Times. Another, deception about man-made global warming. Tim Bell, who is a Canadian meteorologist and climatologist, has done an article in which he's quite skeptical about the Al Gore view of meteorology, so to speak. Many other things there. One titled, Over 60% of Muslims Have Extremist Connections. That's an article by Damian Thomas in The Telegraph, a UK newspaper. And he's talking about Muslims in the UK rather than in this country. There are some 13 or 14 items of that sort. And as usual, we end with a musical find. In this case, and I read my own writing on this, a great musical find for today's final item, Bruno Walter conducting the Vienna Philharmonic and some great soloists in a magnificent performance of Mahler's Lied von der Erde in 1936! Exclamation point. Another thing I do want to tell you is that tomorrow night we will be here for the full 2 hours, but we will be on the internet rather than over the air. When the hockey games come on, we still do a full 2 hour extension 720, but we do it on WGN2, as we now call it, and that's an internet stream which you can get to simply by going to the station's website, and about 15 minutes before the program begins, there's a link. Click on it, and it takes you to the second stream, or to WGN2. You'll hear what I think will be a most interesting program. I'll be there live chatting with about what we're playing, and maybe chatting with you as I respond to phone calls and or emails. But also we'll play two longish excerpts from two great earlier Extension 720 programs. That's tomorrow night on WGN2. Right now on WGN1, we return to John Drummond and quickly back to the phones and to Jim in Rockford, Illinois. Good evening.
Hi, I'm kind of interested for Mr. Drummond. How often would you trade information with the police or maybe give them a lead that you found that maybe you couldn't use?
Or occasionally, usually it's the other way around. Most of the information would come from the police, and I didn't help them very much. But I recall one case. We had a call. There was a number of bookies were being murdered in the early 70s. Check that. Yeah, it was the early 70s. And I got a call from a viewer who said that you ought to check out this guy. This is the guy that's been doing the hitting. It's Butch Petroselli. That name did not ring a bell with me at that time. So I called the police and told them what was said, and they took that certainly very seriously. That was the first time I'd ever heard of Petroselli, and apparently the police felt that might have been very legitimate in that case.
John, here's a psychologist kind of question. What did doing this work do to you? How did it alter your attitudes, your thoughts, your Weltanschauung, your worldview?
The only thing, worldview, of course, I think what this business does, particularly in a large urban center, we're talking about corruption, whether it be political, yeah, police, whatever it is, I think it does make a person, unfortunately, a little more cynical, particularly politicians and others, that what their motive is and what it is. You don't, unfortunately, it gives you, I think that's also true with a lot of police people and people in our business, that you tend to be cynical because you've seen this thing before. I think it does tend to do that, yeah.
Did it ever depress you?
Not so much, because I think realistically I expected that. Yeah, sometimes the passing of a person, obviously that type of thing, a public figure that you thought very highly of or something like that. Or seeing a depression, you talk about homicides when you see a little girl or somebody been killed or something, yeah, like, or assaulted, raped, or a family wiped out in a car accident because of a drunken driver. Those type of things can be very depressing. Yes, it can be.
On the other hand, there must have been much exhilaration.
Yeah, there is. There is an exhilaration of a story. I remember a story, for example, there had always been a long theory that there was an unholy alliance between the mob and politicians. And I recall after Sam, we're going back to Sam Giancana again, but I think this is an important point. I was able to see in Giancana's house, through a filing cabinet there, of a list of, he kept a lot of stuff in that house, by the way. And one of that was a list of his daughter Antoinette's marriage. listed the people who contributed funds to that that marriage, the gift. Now, obviously, the fact that Anthony Accardo or some of the New York mob people like Galanti or somebody like that were there, that's not a surprise in the cash figure. But on that was a number of politicians, judges, city councilmen, board of supervisors with a cash figure behind it. One of those was, by the way, was Vito Marzullo. I remember, who was a very powerful 25th Ward alderman, yeah. Very colorful figure, by the way, who lectured at Harvard, likable guy. But when I called him on that, he denied, of course. Oh, that's not, I know how it got there. I had nothing, didn't A, go to the wedding, and of course I didn't give any money. But I felt at the time that showed there was obviously some connection between
you
the politicians.
Say Marzullo lectured at Harvard. The man who set that up was a good friend of mine, Milton Rakoff.
Okay,
did you know Rakoff?
Yeah, his book is he has a book on daily.
Don't make no waves, don't back no losers.
That's right.
We don't want nobody. Yep. Nobody said. Yep. Milton Rakoff was a professor of political science at UIC. His PhD was from the University of Chicago, and he was a frequent guest on this program in the early days when I first started doing it.
Yeah, that's died to the memories.
Yeah, but he was very close to Marzullo.
Yeah, well, Marzullo's quite a guy.
So I gather. Yeah.
Well, also, I remember covering a wedding with it was Pat Marcy's, Pat Marcy, who was sort of a power broker of the mob, with either his son or his daughter at the Hilton Hotel the same day then in the Cubs, I remember, won the clinch the pennant with Pittsburgh because we were with a truck right out in front of that Hilton Hotel. And we've seen the mob figures going in. There was a couple of aldermen that were there at that time, too, I remember.
Matter of fact, that just brings to my mind the one time I met Vito Marzullo was at the wedding of Milton Rakoff's daughter.
Okay, there you go.
They gave a big wedding.
He's quite a guy, Vito.
Marzullo sat there holding court at a large round table. A last pause for a quick round of commercials, then right back to your phone calls and email. 591-7200 or extension 720 at Tribune.com. And quickly back to the phones with your questions to John Drummond. 591-7200, the number. And we go to Mary in Lake Geneva. Good evening.
Hi. What a wonderful show. I wonder, John, if there's any truth to rumors that we've heard here that Al Capone and his mob used to vacation up on a little lake that's just on the other side of Lake Geneva, and it's known as Lake Como. And that there's rumors that they would, you know, that what is now known as the French Country Inn, it was Bugsy Moran's place, and the resort that was known as the Interlaken was once used as a speakeasy. Is there any truth to that at all?
I can't answer that yes or no. I do know that, of course, Capone did go up to Wisconsin. I know that one place he particularly went to was Couderay. He had a hideout up there, which is near Hayward. There's no question about it. He went there. There's always stories that he went to other places in Wisconsin. How true that is. Remember, a lot of people try to capitalize on it economically with a restaurant or some kind of saying that Capone was here. I know where Lake Como is. I know where that Interlaken Resort is. And whether he ever was there or not, it seems likely that he obviously could have gone into southern Wisconsin because he liked the Badger State, I guess. Whether he actually had a place in that, I don't know. I know there's people that claim he had a spot down in the southern suburbs and places like that, but I do know that he liked up in Wisconsin where he had his own private lake.
It's a little bit like George Washington's left here.
That's exactly right what it is, yes. There you go.
Second question?
Yes,
ma'am, go ahead.
John, what's your opinion of the, now the former HBO series, Sopranos? Did that adequately map to what mob life is like?
Well, as an outsider, of course, I'm not an option. I thought it was done very well. The only thing I would be critical of it was the fact that in the case of the boss getting involved in hits and things like that, usually they isolate themselves and let their soldiers and minions do those type of things.
Like our politicians.
There you go. That's right. So that's why they don't get convicted as often, because they have other people do their chores. In this case, of course, Tony was doing some things himself that I don't think would have happened in real life. Other than that, I think it was pretty realistic.
Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Thank you, ma'am. Glad to have heard from you. And quickly to another, this being Ed in Rockford. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. Like to ask John about it was the 1962 mayoral election. Ben Adam Moskow always kidded Richard J. Daley that he stole the election from him. How close was that election? And a second question for you: Who gave you the monocle Bulldog?
Well, going first, that was the election in 1963 when Adamowski ran against Daley. I don't think it was stolen, but it was a good. I think Daley won it, but Adamowski gave him a pretty good fight. Remember, the regime, the administration, the organization was very fearful of Adamowski, if he became mayor, would have certainly made it tough for some of the guys that had good sinecures with the company and some maybe some corruption. So I think that election was the on and up and Daley defeated Adamowski, but it was his closest. That was his toughest competition. As far as the name Bulldog was concerned, that actually, I'll be honest with you, I was not called Bulldog till I really started at Channel 2, and I think part of that supposedly because I supposedly was very tenacious in getting stories at that time. However, that when I grew up, of course, there was a detective by the name of Bulldog Drummond. We remember that, an English detective. So when I was a kid, people would get names. If your name was Drummond, you'd be Bulldog. If you'd be Rhodes, you'd be Dusty Rhodes. If you're Webb, you're Spider and things like that. But I never had much of that moniker. That didn't start really till I came here. And I don't think people, those people knew about Bulldog Drummond, the detective.
Thank you.
And we thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. 591-7200. One line is available for a second or two. As we go to Jan in Buffalo Grove, you are on the air. Good evening.
My compliments and gratitude to Dr. Rosenberg and Mr. Drummond. Quick question about Al Tapper, T-A-P-P-E-R, and his father. He was married into our family for a little bit in the early 60s, and I'm just curious if you have any information on them.
What is that name again?
Oh, T like Tom, A like Apple, P-P-E-R.
Tapper.
Yeah.
No, I don't. I'm afraid I can't shed any light on that, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for asking.
All right. I guess he was unwelcome in the family.
Yeah, apparently so.
591-7200. And to Melissa in Riverside. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. I apologize. I came into your show a little late, and all I heard was Mr. Drummond talking about that there may be a special about the murders of the ladies in Riverside at Starved Rock.
This is correct. It's not any rumor, anything about it. What happened was that a movie is, I think they're done filming. It's a documentary about Chester Otto Uyghur, who, of course, in 1960, according to the authorities in LaSalle County, killed the three women from Riverside who were down on their vacation at Starved Rock Lodge.
What year was that?
It was March of 1960. It happened that Uyghur was confessed in November of 1960, and then they had a trial in early 1961. He's been incarcerated ever since.
Okay, I've been rather fascinated since I grew up in Riverside. I was not born until 62.
Mm-hmm.
However, the school that I went to had a memorial to these women, and I believe I lived next to the widow.
They were three. They were
of one of the women.
They were three prominent. The three prominent families from Riverside.
Yes.
What happened? They went down there in March to get away from it all, do some hiking around Starved Rock, which is of course beautiful. And one of the husbands got concerned. They called the lodge. They went down. I forget which day of the week. Maybe it was Monday. And they called when they didn't. The moment the women got down there, they went out for a hike and they never returned. Their bodies were found in what they called St. Louis Canyon.
Yes, it was always very hush-hush in the town of Riverside, though.
I'm sure it must have been at that time.
Although there was a memorial plaque at the junior high school in a reading area outside the junior high. And as I said, I believe I moved into the widower of one of the women.
Mm-hmm.
And he subsequently was remarried and had other children.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it's always kind of intrigued me because not much is said around town about it.
Surprised me.
I was not born until 62.
You said born in 62, so yes, you, of course. Well, the thing is, it was at the time it was one of these so-called crimes of the century. In fact, Life magazine even did a takeout on it, because the murder happened, of course, at a very pristine, the top park in the Illinois system. Crimes of that nature weren't supposed to happen there.
No, exactly. And I think people still don't want to talk about it to this day.
I know they didn't at the lodge when they first got there, but there is a film, a documentary has been made, and I know that the producers are telling me they're going to try to enter that in one of these festivals, like the one out in Park City, Utah, and then the one also possibly even in Cannes in France. So we'll see what happens. I think it's going to be released next year, or 2009.
Pardon? And how would I look to follow up on that?
In what way? For the movie? Well, of course, when it'll come out, it'll obviously be publicity about that, but
I believe Mr. Drummond said it was a documentary type.
Yes, it is. A documentary. That's correct. It is. It would be interviews with Uyghur himself. See, Uyghur confessed to this thing, and then he said that he did so because he's under pressure. One of the sheriff's deputies that were interviewing him said he would ride the thunderbolt if he didn't talk, meaning he'd go to the electric chair. And he claimed they browbeat him. They browbeat him, and he confessed, and then he later recanted. So that's the thrust of the story. Did Uyghur actually do it, or was he framed?
And with that, we have to move on. Time very short. Lots of people still want to get in on this. And we go next to Steve in Schaumburg, good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, John and Milt. John, I've followed your career over the years, and it's been a great one. I also saw you down at the Family Secrets mm-hmm. trial last year. What was your opinion of the late Art Patak with the Sun-Times, who I also followed pretty religiously? I just wanted to get your opinion, please.
Art Patak for years was a police reporter with the Sun-Times. Father was a cop. He's the old school guy. Art was not much of a writer. In other words, he would call in stories to rewrite. Guys do that. He was not known as a writer, but he was a good digger. He had good sources. And sometimes he'd hit a little hard, sometimes maybe stretch a few things, but he was very resourceful. He was very resourceful, and he got a Pulitzer Prize, didn't he, for that expose regarding the murders of the Percy people.
Did I ever tell you about the night Art was on with a famous gangster whose name I do not remember? You will remember it. It was a Jewish guy who...
From the West, Mickey Cohn?
Mickey Cohn,
yeah, from Los Angeles, yeah.
I was about to say, from the Hollywood culture. Did I ever tell you about that story?
No.
Cohen had done a book or something.
That's right. He was in
book
pitching a book because I interviewed him at that time.
And Art Patak was the other guest on the program. And Art amazed me. In the middle of the program, he suddenly leaned towards Mickey and said, "Mickey, did you ever murder anybody?" And Cohen said, "Oh, yeah, sure. But they all deserved it." And I thought, what is this guy doing? He's confessing to murder on the air.
That's right.
And he said, "It don't matter now. There's a statute of limitations."
There ain't no statute of limitations.
Of course, there's no. Exactly. No one ever, the FBI never picked up on it. That was said on the program.
That's a great story.
Yeah. When the program was over, Cohen insisted on signing the book for me, but he couldn't write.
He couldn't?
Just barely. I stood by him as he labored milli-inch by milli-inch, you know, for about 15 minutes to sign his name and maybe one in very brief comment. But he said, "You're the professor. I'm going to sign the book for you." It was just a classic scene.
That's a great scene.
Yeah.
Now, Mickey Cohn was a colorful guy. There's no question about
it. What did
that.
You make of him?
Well, for a mob guy, he wouldn't do that in Chicago, going on a book sale, and he was talking and telling about what he did and things like that. He did similar things like us. But Chicago guys would never do that. The outfit guys would.
There's another guy. Columbo was one of the big families in New York.
That's New York, yeah. He was at the they had that rally, and he was shot by...
Yeah, but his son... Was it a son who wrote the book? No, I'm thinking of somebody else.
You're thinking maybe the Bonanno family?
Bonanno, yeah. not Columbo, yeah. Bonanno.
Yeah.
I'm getting those vowel-ending names confused. And young Bonanno wrote a book. Did you meet him at the time?
As a matter of fact, I interviewed him out in Tucson, Arizona, and his wife at that time. I remember that in 1995, that is young Bonanno. I never met the old man, Joe.
Yeah.
No, never met the old man.
Great hierarchies of
a
sort.
That's right.
Yeah. You ever met a criminal you really liked?
Well, the most interesting guy, one guy by the name of Larry Newman, by the way. He was a man who did not have, he was an enforcer. But he was a man who actually came from very comfortable circumstances. He had something like an annuity every year of about $15,000, which wasn't bad back in the 40s and 50s. He didn't have to turn it to a crime. And then he was implicated in a number of murders. His name surfaced, by the way, the other day in a newspaper story in the Sun-Times about a killing up in McHenry County where two people were killed. And he was involved at the time I interviewed him. He was on trial, going to be on trial for murdering a jeweler here in Chicago. But he actually was out in Las Vegas, worked for Tony Spilotro and the Over the Hill gang.
And you like the man?
Well, you're fearful of him, yet you're fascinated by him. I mean, he certainly. Well, another guy actually was likable. I hate to say it was Jackie Cerrone. Well, he was on the camera. He would talk. I could see why he was capable of dealing with judges and businessmen and politicians. Uh-huh. Yeah, not all these guys are Dems and Dozers. Don't get that idea.
No, surely
no,
not.
No.
John, thank you so much for joining us again tonight.
Thanks for the good words.
It's always a great pleasure for me. And let's remind all of our listeners, if they haven't got their hands on it yet, that the most recent book by John Drummond is titled It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real. And that's published by Evanston Press.
That's correct.